This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, we do a walkabout on the military turmoil throughout the continent of Africa. We'll be joined live by Professor Horace Campbell of Syracuse University, and looking at recent events in everywhere from Mali to Algeria to Egypt, and looking at the activities of AFRICOM. We'll also be speaking about his new book, Global NATO and the Catastrophe in Libya. Also today, we'll get a first on-the-ground report from the Oxford Union event that recently took place in London and was addressed by Julian Assange. One of the honorees at the Sam Adams Awards was Ray McGovern. He joins us live today as well. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight. All that coming up right after this. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're very pleased to be joined now live by Professor Horace Campbell, a professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Syracuse University. He is also a recent guest of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC and the author of the upcoming Global NATO and the Catastrophe in Libya from Monthly Review Press. And there are so many things on the continent I want to ask you about, but just first, welcome back to the Shadow, Horace.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's go from east to west in the northern tip of Africa. There is so much instigation, turmoil, and ideological conflict that seems to either have erupted or gained our attention recently, with the anniversary of Tahrir in Egypt, the jihadi activities in Algeria, the French incursion into Mali, and so on. What is your overall state of the state of the continent of Africa?
Well, I think for your audience, the important challenge for us is to cut through all of the disinformation and news that is going on about Africa. The most important event which we should focus on in Africa is the revolution in North Africa, especially in Egypt, and the repercussions of that revolution. That revolution has now gone through a number of stages, and as that revolution matures, all of the conservative forces in the world that support neoliberalism are afraid, because the resolution of the questions of health, quality of life, wages, healthcare, employment, and the well-being of the 80 million Egyptians, these questions cannot be solved. And so, because neoliberalism is in a crisis, we've had counter-revolution in North Africa. The counter-revolution started with the NATO intervention in Libya. This was the strategic plan to stab the Egyptian revolution in its back. That NATO intervention has backfired, because when NATO intervened under the so-called responsibility to protect, they have gone to Libya and created more destruction. There are at least 50,000 Libyans who were killed. Today, the Libyan society is unstable. There's no real government in Libya. There are 1,700 militias running around Libya who control major towns. And even the United States of America could not guarantee the security of its ambassador in Libya and the Central Intelligence Agency. In fact, my book, The Catastrophic Failure of NATO in Libya, points to the fact that General Petraeus and the CIA were training the same people they call jihadists and had a base in Benghazi. The biggest CIA base in North Africa was in Benghazi to train them to send to Syria. So this is a counter-revolution. Now, when that failed, and that counter-revolution has brought such shame on the United States, France, and Britain to the point where the United States administration are saying they want to wind down the war on terror, France came in with Act 2 of counter-revolution to come in to Mali to say they're trying to stop jihadists. Now, bear this in mind. The United Nations Resolution 28085 that mandated a West African force to go into Mali to clean up these jihadists. This was a mandate for ECOWAS and African forces. But France opportunistically intervened in Mali at a point when they knew that the jihadists were overstretched, because these four different groups that are called jihadists, they could not control a population of 15 million persons in Mali. They've carried out a lot of destruction. So France opportunistically intervened to preempt the African intervention and then said that they were saving Africa from being overtaken by the jihadists, when the very jihadists that they're talking about were the people that they supported in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi and to kill Gaddafi.
Professor Campbell, one of the anomalies about the events in Libya, which I think any analyst would agree with you, were completely both tragic and counter-African, counter-revolutionary. The Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently stated before Congress, "What does it matter how they died?" referring to the ambassador and several support personnel. And yet, I am not yet convinced of that assertion, because it is my understanding that in his trip to Benghazi, following his close liaising with what I refer to as the racist Cyrenaicans of the eastern partition of Libya that are now engaged in the deprivation of life of Afro-Libyans, or people who appear to be of primarily African heritage, the ambassador J. Christopher Stevens, according to many reports, was engaged not only in prior contact and perhaps suborning of the Libyan militias that would overthrow the Jamahiriya, but was also scheduled, according to some records that have been retrieved, to meet with his counterpart from Turkey, which I'm sure you know has been one of the conduits for the expansion of jihadi forces armed by the weapons pilfered from Libyan stockpiles during the overthrow. Can you speak more to that and how that impinges on neighboring nations?
Well, in Mali and in Libya, the Pentagon, the State Department, and the National Security Council of the White House need to have a thorough review of the past practices of the United States of America. In the case of Mali, for the past 10 years, under something called the Trans-Sahel in the Counterterrorism Initiative, they spent $500 million training people in counterterrorism. And some of the people they trained are the very same persons who they are now fighting. Secondly, the American military trained the captain who carried out the coup d'etat in Mali that has destabilized Mali. He came to the United States six times. Thirdly, the Libyan intervention was an intervention which colluded with third-party countries such as Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. These third-party countries, as you pointed out, have been the main source of finance and weaponry for the jihadists. So here we are, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, allies of the United States of America, providing resources in terms of finance and weapons for the jihadists, and the United States of America, France, and Britain are fighting the jihadists who are the same allies. This is hypocrisy. This is a way to militarize Africa and to ensure that there's a hype in the United States that there's a global war on terror.
There's a saying, don't cry over spilt milk, but it appears to be the United States and NATO that spilt the jihadis into the region with the overthrow of Libya and the arming of subversive elements that are now attempting to overthrow Syria and taking refuge in neighboring places in the Sahel, such as in Algeria and in Mali. So with the invasion or the intervention by the French military in Mali and the intimations that Algeria might well be on the target list, is France attempting to clean up America's spilt milk?
No. No. France is attempting to remilitarize Africa in a way which would bring the United States Africa Command in a more expanded role in North Africa. In November, the chief counsel for the Pentagon, Jay Johnson, gave a speech at the Oxford Union in England, where he said the war on terror is winding down now that many of the leaders have been killed, and that the United States should be using law enforcement mechanisms to continue to mop up the other elements involved in the war on terror. Jay Johnson did not last a month within the Pentagon after that, because there are elements within the national security and foreign policy establishment that has created the propaganda that Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb presents a major threat to the United States of America. So this debate, which is going on within the United States administration about whether the Pentagon's budget should be cut or not, France intervened and is getting their allies in the United States of America to support them by supporting with refueling capabilities. And now we have heard yesterday that the British said they will be sending 200 trainers in. This is part of an effort by France and Britain to push their alliance with the more conservative elements in the United States of America. General Carter Ham of the United States Africa Command, in giving a speech in Howard University, said that the United States made a lot of mistakes in North Africa and in Mali. What the peace movement should be saying to the Obama administration, spell out what these mistakes are. How are you going to be sure that the U.S. Africa Command will not repeat those mistakes? Because if you do not spell out what those mistakes are, that is spending $500 million training people who you fight later on, training soldiers who create a coup d'etat to destabilize Mali, allying themselves with people who are smugglers, gunruggers, drug dealers, and call them terrorists. If we do not have a clarity about this, then the media will continue to promote stories that Africa is a hotbed of terrorism, which is not the case. Africa is a hotbed of revolution where the people want a better standard of living.
Dr. Campbell, to bring this up to date, overnight there was an indication that President Barack Obama is moving forward with new drone bases in, near, and surrounding Mali, and that in addition to the ones that already exist in places like Djibouti and Ethiopia and Somalia, and that in conjunction with a remarkable statement from a member of the State Department, an undersecretary for African Affairs named Don Yamamoto. He's quoted as saying that of the Mali intervention with France, that quote, this is only the first phase. It's going to take time. I think people should not be into the illusion that it is going to be quick, end quote. And to paraphrase Samuel L. Jackson from the movie Shaft, do you think that makes AFRICOM and the Obama administration less likely or more likely to have a deep intervention in Northern Africa?
Well, the extent to which the Obama administration increases its militarism in Africa is the extent to which the peace movement and the media is clear about what's going on in Africa. If the peace movement is very clear that we should dismantle AFRICOM, if the peace movement is very clear that the United States' engagement with Africa should not be military, but should be based on the needs of the African people, that is to have employment, reconstruction, healthcare, education, building schools, if our engagement within the peace movement sends signal to our congresspersons, to people to say that the problem we have now, we must investigate and evaluate what happened in Libya, evaluate what happened in Mali with the United States trans-Sahara. If it is not up to the Obama administration, it is up to the peace movement. And to the extent that the peace movement does its work within the Association of Concerned Africans, we as academics, we're calling for a major campaign to demilitarize Africa. The extent to which the media and the progressive media supports the academics and peace forces who want to demilitarize Africa, that is the extent to which the decision will be made within the Obama administration. Obama, by himself in his National Security Council, will be pushed by those who believe that the war on terror is increasing within Africa.
Well, let us hope that the peace movement does not remain so much at peace when it comes to the militarization of Africa. We're speaking with Professor Horace Campbell of Syracuse University, where he is a professor of African American studies as well as political science, and the author of the upcoming book, Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya. And that's with Monthly Review Press. Can you tell us what exegesis you present in this?
The main argument of the book is that the United States of America supported jihadists in Libya and confused the world by saying that there was an imminent threat of genocide in Benghazi in order to remove the Gaddafi government. The main argument of the book is that if there's to be a revolution in Libya, it has to be undertaken by the Libyan people. And France, Britain, and the United States do not have the moral authority to go into any part of Africa to say they're bringing peace and stability. That's the first point. The second point is about Western people, especially banks and Wall Street, being jealous of the billions of dollars that Libya had in reserves, and that Libya was part of a plan for creating an African monetary union and a common currency. The third point about it was the fact that the so-called jihadists, people like the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, people who the United States call terrorists, those were the same, very same people that the United States financed and moved in to overthrow Gaddafi. The fifth point, was the fact that Libya today is ungovernable. It is overrun by militias. And the last point is that it is being used as a base by the CIA for the destabilization of North Africa and to support differing forces to ensure that there's instability as a basis for preempting African unity and peace in Africa. That's the thesis of the book. The book is called Global NATO and the Catastrophic Failure in Libya, and will be out in March from Monthly Review Press.
Well, we'll certainly speak with you again on the publication of the book. And I'd just like to footnote something you said early on in the interview, and I just want to verify that I heard you correctly, that in the new catastrophic state, if it can be called that, of Libya, that there are some 7,000 militias?
No, 1700.
1700. I'm sorry, I misheard you. Well, that's still a phenomenal number.
Yes.
1700 militias. And
this is what is called a success by the media. When every day we hear of the insecurity for the Libyan people, and what we cannot explain is how some group could cross the desert for 1,000 kilometers to go to attack that Algerian oil facility. There's so much going on that is opaque that people would need clarity on.
Well, I thank you for the clarity you've brought to us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. Professor Horace Campbell of Syracuse University, Department of African American and Political Science Studies. And for those who are impatient to wait for the book release in March, how else can they follow your work?
Well, they can go to Pambazuka News, which is one of the progressive blogs and websites coming out that promotes the peace and security and the unity of the African people and those in the progressive world.
Well, thank you, Dr.
Thank
Campbell.
You very
this
much
has
for
been
having me.
Truly enlightening. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll have the latest word on what happened in London with Julian Assange and the Sam Adams Awards when we speak with Ray McGovern. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And there was controversy over the past week in London when Julian Assange addressed the Oxford Union by way of video link from his asylum-seeking sanctuary in the Ecuadorian embassy. The occasion was the Sam Adams Awards for Intelligence Whistleblowers. And among the honorees of that event were Thomas Finger, Colleen Rowley, Annie Mahan, Anne Wright, Thomas Drake, Jessalyn Raddick, and our live guest today, Ray McGovern, who was also a key speaker there and has just returned from that venue. And Ray, we are all a Twitter as to know what really happened in London.
Well, Robert, it was a very proper event, I must say. We were very fortunate in having a progressive leadership in the Oxford Union, the very famous debating society that goes back 190 years. And when they heard that we were going to give an award for truth-telling and free debate, that was right up their alley. And so it was a very easy sell to have them host us. And when they heard that Julian Assange was one of the previous winners of the Sam Adams Award, this is the Sam Adams Award for Integrity in Intelligence, he won it in 2010, they thought, wow, this is great. Why don't we have him piped in from his timeshare, what I call his timeshare, in the Ecuadorian embassy. For those of your audience who don't know, he's a political prisoner. British authorities are doing the bidding of the United States and keeping him a prisoner in the Ecuadorian embassy in which he has political asylum. He's afraid to leave there lest he be extricated or what's the word? He would be brought to the United States and tried for treason, even though, he'd be subjected to the same kind of treatment that Bradley Manning, who now admits that he made those cables available to WikiLeaks. So it was quite an extraordinary passive events when it was learned that Julian Assange would be one of the speakers, albeit by a video stream for 20 minutes. Well, the interest peaked, and there were a couple of demonstrations against it. I have to say that I was as surprised as I was disappointed. You know, I take a backseat to no one on the feminist issue. I am what my Catholic leaders call a radical feminist. They think that's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. I was pretty much thrown out of my parish for demonstrating against the subordination of women. So I take no backseat to feminists, but, you know, to naive young ladies who buy the propaganda line that Julian Assange is fleeing justice by not answering to not accusations, not charges, but allegations by some folks in Sweden, they buy it hook, line, and sinker. And sure, they were out there. And usually I'm not being demonstrated against, but in this case, we Sam Adams Associates were being demonstrated against by well-meaning young women who don't know that Julian Assange is the victim of a slur campaign that just won't quit.
Well, on the legal level, there is no indictment. He has offered to cooperate with queries from the Swedish authorities, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the concern here is not about a cavalier attitude in regard to violence and or rape and or the accusations thereof, but rather a legal propriety in terms of not only the absence of an indictment, but also the high likelihood, as revealed through Stratfor, of a secret United States indictment and a greater amount of pressure that might be put upon Sweden were Assange to enter their custody. Is that an accurate representation?
That's exactly right, yeah. It's a done deal. There is a secret indictment in the court at Alexandria, and I don't know how they, you know, when the New York Times published the same material, the question is why they're going after Assange and not the New York Times. Is he a journalist? Of course he's a journalist. He's doing the job that the mainstream journalism here should be doing. Now, the important thing for people to know about Julian Assange is that when he was when he had this sort of this affair with the two young ladies there in Sweden, they seemed to be just fine with it. They met with them the next day at a public forum, and they were all... Then all of a sudden, a couple of days later, someone got to these ladies, and all of a sudden, Julian became the victim of allegations, not accusations. Julian Assange spent 6 more weeks in Sweden pleading with the Swedish authorities to question him, to ask him about these things. They would not do it. He left for London, and they issued a warrant for his arrest immediately. The London people kept him for about a year in some estate, and then they decided that they would deny his request not to be extradited to Sweden, from which it's a very sure step to the United States. And so he sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, and to his credit, Correa, the head of Ecuador, said, "Sounds like political prisoner to me." So he's been there for the last 7 months.
Ray, one of the things that delayed the availability of Julian Assange's address to the Oxford Union on the occasion of the Sam Adams Award for Ethical People, Whistleblowers and Intelligence, yourself included, as a former presidential briefer with the Central Intelligence Agency on the daily presidential briefings through a number of presidential terms, as well as your involvement with veteran intelligence people for sanity. One of the odd reasons given by the union for not immediately publishing the proceedings or even live streaming them, as they promised, was because of a concern that the collateral murder video of the U.S. slaughter of Iraqi civilians from helicopter gunships would, in their words, potentially violate United States copyright law.
Now, I heard, you know, I come from the Bronx, as you know, Robert. Yeah, we know a crock when we see one. That was almost too ludicrous. Yeah, they've delayed this, but I have to say, you know, there are all kinds of pressures on these young people that run the Oxford Union. I think it's highly to their credit that they let us in there. Let us do our thing, which is really, really important. And I'd like to just get a word in about that. We've been giving this award for integrity and intelligence for 10 years now. And as I say, 2 years ago, we had Julian Assange as our awardee. And this time, it was a fellow named Tom Finger, who has never been heard of. But he's the archetypical professional, okay? Now, what happened? Well, we know what happened before Iraq. The intelligence was, please don't believe that it was mistaken. The intelligence before Iraq was fraudulent. It was deliberate fraud. And that was known, and it was embedded in a national intelligence estimate which greased the skids to war against Iraq. And so the next target of the neocons who were responsible for the war in Iraq was Iran. And someone had the presence of mind to say, hey, let's not have another fiasco like that. Let's have an honest guy in here to run the estimate on Iran. And they did. And they asked Tom Finger, who happened to be the head of the State Department Intelligence Unit. He came in, brought his own people in, worked all year during 2007, and in November 2007, 2 weeks after George Bush warned about Iran getting a nuclear weapon and asking the question, what do you want? World War III is what he said. 2 weeks after that, Tom Finger's estimate came out, and it said Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work on that weapon. That judgment, Robert, has been reaffirmed every year since by the Director of National Intelligence in formal testimony, sworn testimony before Congress. And long story short, coming as it did in November of 2007, this estimate is the only one I can say this about that I know of, and I've been around 50 years. This estimate played a huge role in stopping war with Iran, because Bush and Cheney fully planned to do Iran, so to speak, before they left office the next year. The juggernaut was already hurtling down the hill. And this estimate allowed the senior military of our country, who knew what a war with Iran would be like, to say, Mr. President, we really ought to get this up and out so the American people know what a difference this is in the previous estimates. And the president fell for that. The judgments were published. and there was no longer any possibility that there would be a war on Iran. Now, how do we know that this was planned? Well, just read Bush's memoir. He says, I don't know why the intelligence people said this. You know, it didn't even occur to him that it might have been the truth, right? Then he said, this tied my hands militarily, for how could I order our military to attack a country when the entire intelligence community says they have no active military nuclear program, end quote. Well, bummer. You know, if they were really concerned about it, don't you think the appropriate reaction would have been, wow, are you sure? Go back and look at that evidence. No nuclear. Well, let's tell the Israelis right away. Well, the whole thing's a crock. The Israelis and the Americans knew full well that the Iranians had not been working on a nuclear weapon, and that's true today. And what was beautiful here is that Julian Assange, in his 20 minutes, was able to indicate that his sources had given him a copy of a new movie that's coming out in November, okay? It's a DreamWorks thing. It's called The Fifth Estate. And what does it do? It tells this tale about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, and that our spy is just about able to reveal that when, guess what happens? WikiLeaks leaks the spy's name, the spy goes down the drain, and the free world is at risk. It was just the most absurd propaganda.
Hey, Ray, it's a zero dark moment. It's a zero dark moment for truth in movies.
You got it, man. But, you know, it was so good because Julian got on and he said, you know, I applaud Mr. Finger for his good work. That's the way it should be. We should be able to prevent these wars from the inside, from honest intelligence officers. But this is what happens. And then he revealed this movie. And, you know, between that and Zero Dark Thirty, we've got a Hollywood that's actually plumbing for more and more wars. I don't understand that.
Every time one of these comes out, I'm put in the Hurt Locker once again.
Yeah. Well, you know, they should know better. And, you know, I'm not one for censorship, but when you give the air of reality to something that never works, namely torture, I mean, we have the head of Army Intelligence saying in 2006, and this is a quote, no good intelligence has ever come from abusive interrogation techniques. History has shown that, and the empirical evidence of the last 5 years, hard years, also shows that.
Ray, I know that you have commitments, but in regard to your presence and your being honored and presenting at the Sam Adams Awards at the Oxford Union, along with the presentation by Julian Assange and Thomas Drake and Jesselyn Raddick and Anne Wright and Annie Macon and Colleen Rowley and Thomas Finger, here's the thing I have to ask you. What did you have to say?
Well, actually, I introduced the proceedings by talking about my friend and colleague, Sam Adams, after whom the award is named. Sam and I joined the CIA at the same time, having been spirited down to Washington by the words of John Kennedy, who, as you'll remember, said, ask what you can do for your country. We were analysts. We were not operators. And Sam found out when he looked at how many communists under arms there were in South Vietnam, found out that there were twice as many as our military there, General Westmoreland and General Abrams, would admit to. He told me about a cable that he received from General Abrams. And General Abrams says, we can't possibly admit the upper figures, which were Sam Adams's figures, namely 600,000 Vietnamese communists under arms in the South. This is a direct quote. We can't possibly go with Sam Adams's numbers because we have been projecting an image of success in this war. And there is no way that no matter how many caveats we would surround it with, this information would not be misused by the press to give an erroneous and gloomy conclusion about the war. The date of that cable was August 20, 1967, just a few months before the countrywide offensive at Tet, where the communists showed themselves to be in 600,000 numbers, okay? So Sam fought the good fight. His estimate was rejected by the head of the CIA, who thought that his primary job was to protect the CIA and did not want to get into a big dispute with the U.S. Army while it was at war. So that was a bad news estimate. The one in Iraq was equally bad. And so to honor Tom Finger as the 10th recipient of this award was just a distinction that that we gloried in, and adding to the luster, of course, was the forum, the debate chamber of the Oxford Union. And it was just an incredibly moving evening, and I do hope that the YouTube or whatever they use to convey the results of this will show the proceedings. Tom Finger gave an excellent speech which explained what the real duty of an intelligence manager is, to do these things secretly, to avoid pressure from the White House and from Congress, and just serve up the truth without fear or favor. And as I say, and I'll say one more time, I've been around for 50 years. I've seen many national intelligence estimates, and I've chaired a couple myself, okay? This is the only one, the one done on Iran, the nuclear, in November 2007, that I can say with great confidence played a huge role in stopping a war that Cheney and Bush had planned for the following year.
Ray, it's such an honor to have you here on 5 O'Clock Shadow with your long history as an analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency and daily presidential briefer, and your work with VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and of course your publications from time to time on Consortium News. What more can people do to take advantage of your experience and your insight from the Oxford Union and your most recent work?
Well, we will be publishing more on this as soon as some more footage becomes available. I do have a website that my son set up for me. It's very easy, raymcgovern.com. And virtually everything I do for consortiumnews.com, plus the interviews I give, are all posted there, raymcgovern.com.
Well, thank you for being with us today, Ray McGovern. Thanks also to Horace Campbell. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. And we note that today's program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins. And we welcome your tips, comments, queries, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. That's theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone, oh no. Something inside so strong, oh, something inside so strong. The more you refuse to hear my voice, our lies will come tumbling. Deny my place and time, you squander wealth that's mine. My light will shine so brightly, it will blind you. 'Cause there's something inside so strong, so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone.
something inside so strong. Sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough, well, we know better. Just look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway, we're gonna do it anyway. Something inside so strong, and I know that I can make it. You're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. But no, there's something inside so strong.
Strong.